sautarasya tanayam upayemi iravatim janami jayadim chaturas tasya utpadayat sutam. Translation, King Parikshit married the daughter of King Uttara and begot four sons headed by Maharaj Janamejaya. He repeats, King Parikshit married the daughter of King Uttara.
King Parikshit married the daughter of King Uttara.
And begot four sons.
And begot four sons.
Headed by Maharaj Janamejaya.
Okay, I'm going to mute everybody. Reconferencing, and we all have veteran members here, so we all have to mute on Skype. Just one second. We're ready.
Okay, so Prabhupada keep God. Maharaj Uttara was the son of Virat and maternal uncle of Maharaj Parikshit. Iravati, being the daughter of Maharaj Uttara, was the cousin sister of Maharaj Parikshit. But cousin brothers and sisters were allowed to get married if they did not belong to the same gotra or family. In the Vedic system of marriage, the importance of the gotra or family was stressed. Arjuna also married Subhadra, although she was his maternal cousin. Maharaj Janamejaya, one of the famous kings, Maharaj Janamejaya. And I've heard somebody, I probably asked somebody, do you like these biographies? And they said, yes, they're very nice, Prabhupada. And they said, yes, I spent a lot of time in the library, like researching them. So, I haven't seen them recently, but some time ago I've seen a couple of Puranic encyclopedias, and they're very nice because they go through them in just like different names and places like that alphabetically, and they give these references like that, collecting them from different Puranas, different information. Janamejaya, it says, one of the Rajarishis, kings, and the famous son of Maharaj Parikshit. His mother's name was Iravati, or according to some, Madhravati. Maharaj Janamejaya begot two sons of the name Jatanika and Shankukarna. He celebrated several sacrifices in the Kurukshetra pilgrimage site. And he had three younger brothers named Shutasena, Ugrasena, Bhimasena too, like that. He invaded Takshila, Ajanta. He decided to avenge the unlawful curse of his great father, Maharaj Parikshit. He performed a great sacrifice called Sarpa Yajna to kill the race of serpents, including the Takshika, which had bitten his father to death. On request of many influential demigods and sages, he had to change his decision to kill the race of snakes. But despite stopping the sacrifice, he satisfied everyone concerned in the sacrifice by rewarding them properly. In the ceremony, Mahamuni Vyasadeva also was present. And he personally narrated the history of the Battle of Kurukshetra before the king. Later on, by the order of Vyasadeva, his disciple Vaishampayan narrated before the king the subject matter of the Mahabharata. He was very much affected by his great father's untimely death and was very anxious to see him again, and he expressed his desire before the great sage Vyasadeva. Vyasadeva also fulfilled his desire. His father was present before him, and he worshipped both his father and Vyasadeva with great respect and pomp. Being fully satisfied, he most munificently gave charities to the brahmanas present at the sacrifice. So, myself, I don't know if this is being described from the Mahabharata, but also, as far as I understand, from the Padma Purana and Vishnu Purana and Harivamsa, which is supposedly I've heard as a supplement to the Mahabharata, and Prabhupada quotes it sometimes. You know, there are descriptions of these pastimes of Krishna. And, you know, so there are more details than what we have from the Bhagavatam. I think it's in terms of when Arjuna was going to see Mahavishnu along with Krishna after the sons of the Brahmana were being kidnapped. And probably there are quotes from the Harivamsa describing the horses, I think, like that, and what their names were and so on. Yeah. So there are different sources, you know. What strikes us is that, of course, this whole chapter is about the birth of Maharaj Parikshit. And again, you know, the whole first council starts off with the situation that Naimisharanya, the sages are disturbed because they can't get any good result to purify the atmosphere by fire sacrifices. So they ask Sutta, and Sutta Goswami then becomes their advisor on how to deal with life. And he answers their questions. What is the best sacrifice? What is the best dharma? What is the best scripture? What is the different meaning of all these different incarnations? What lessons can we take from them when they come like that? And especially, what lessons can we take from Krishna's incarnation? Like that. Yeah. It's kind of to me, it's kind of a difficult thing to compensate, because by Prabhupada's mercy, and I think also by Christianity, because everything this way and that way, but Christianity, at least the Catholic Church, mostly, has been able to maintain a pretty monotheistic an idea. There were so many, what is it called, heresies, when I understand, the Albigensian heresy, what does the guy call it, Manichaeists. And they were presenting that, you know, God is like impersonal or something like that, or maybe he exists, like Carmela Mimamsa, or maybe he doesn't exist, but he doesn't have any concern with us. So we just have to do our duty under the laws of Dharma, and then we'll get different results, you know. So they actually fought with all this to keep a very clear monotheistic view of reality. And in India, you know, the same kind of confusion appears to be there in so many ways like that. And even if one accepts a deity, then which deity like that? You know? Krishna is an incarnation of Vishnu. He's showing the way of lusty love to people. Or Shiva showing the way of smoking marijuana to people, you know. Yeah. So many different speculations. Yeah. And then finally, you know, we have from Christianity and from Srila Prabhupada, my goodness, such a clear understanding of what's going on, at least, you know, like that. So the Bhagavatam starts off with this, the sages taking Sutta Goswami, he starts presenting Srimad Bhagavatam, you know. The essence of Krishna is the Supreme Person. Ete cham sasakal pumsam, and Krishna is too Bhagavan Swayam. And Krishna is the Supreme Personality of all these different incarnations. Yeah. And so much philosophical discussion about these things. So then he tells them these things, but they say, well, you know, again, there are already so many Vedas, but you say Srimad Bhagavatam is so supreme. What was the necessity, and where did the impetus come from? So then three chapters, Narada and Vyas, how Vyasadeva appreciated the Vedas were not correct. Narada confirmed his opinion and told him he had to write a direct, strong book. And so then he started the impetus. And before, because it's a Purana especially, you know, there's the background, you know, who's talking to who, who's receiving it. And so then the chapters 7, 8, 9, I think it is. What do we have there? We have there Son of Drona Punished, 7. Prayers by Kunti and Yudhisthira asking Krishna to stay, which he did, 8. Disappearance of Bhishmadeva, 9. Then 10 and 11 are Krishna going back to Dwarka. But then 12, he pulls back again and starts talking again about, you know, the things he was going to talk about originally, which was the birth of Maharaj Parikshit, disappearance of the Pandavas, and all these kind of things like that. I didn't miss something here. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And then finally, the actual meeting, you know, of Sukadeva Goswami and Maharaj Parikshit, like that. Yeah. So, so this is after that situation. I don't know how old Maharaj Parikshit was when. Maharaj Janamejaya. I don't know how old he was when he was married. When Maharaj Parikshit disappeared like that. It says he was very affected, so he may have been. I didn't think about that until today. Was he like 5 years old, 6 years old, 15 years old? Yeah. I think the more we hear about these things, wow, the more we want to like, you know, understand all the details. You know, how old were people? What was happening? You know? They're not only real facts. Like Harry Potter is interesting, but it never happens, as far as I know. Like that. Yeah. So, but we want to hear all these, not only all these actual historical facts, which is interesting, but these are transcendental facts. We experience that. They're self-manifesting. As you begin to hear about these things, you start to understand things. Jayananda told us, Prabhupada said, if you just go on chanting Hare Krishna, you'll start to see pastimes that you never read in any of my books. Like that. So I think it's like that. These are self-effulgent things. Ideas start coming into your head, which you can confirm by intelligence, or then we can find other scriptural sources, like that. Yeah. So the kind of ideas coming to me about the whole perspective here, and then and again, it's a whole different atmosphere. That's why it's so nice, because you get to really understand this is not like the Kali Yuga. Everybody takes these things as myths, legends, you know, being produced like that. But actually, it's describing, no, this is actually what happened. You know? But then, of course, it didn't happen in our present atmosphere of Kali Yuga, which is like in the wintertime. There weren't fruit trees growing, giving, you know, what was the second? Big fruit tree can give, hundreds, you know. Cherries, how many cherries does a big fruit tree give? Hundreds, you know. But somebody in the wintertime, they may have no fruits or something like that, don't even exist, or some kind of like hothouse fruit. Yeah. So, but no, these different ages existed. I mean, maybe I mentioned it before, but one of the real big critical things was this thing about carbon dating. That carbon, the number of, number of neutrons and protons together in the nucleus, according to that method of carbon, I think it's 12, okay? But then there's some kind of ions, I guess they call them ions. I guess you have a couple more hydrogen atoms tossed in. There's carbon 14, not carbon 12. So it decays. It decays back down to carbon 12. So then the idea is that living beings, they take this in, but they stop taking it in when they die. So therefore, if you look at the amount of carbon-14 in an animal or some bones like that, therefore you can say, oh, it decayed this much, it decayed that much, and you can say it's, you know, 500 years old. I don't know, maybe 500, but it may take longer than that, 1,000, 2,000, and they project it to like Lucy and, you know, 1 million-year-old bones. Things like that. So it sounds like a kind of good argument, but I finally went to the Wikipedia, which is not all that accurate, but usually pretty good. And the problem is that the carbon-14 is produced in a higher atmosphere. It's not produced much on the Earth by the influence of these cosmic rays or extraterrestrial rays hitting the higher atmosphere. And they say there, quite quickly it passes right by, that we assume that the amount of carbon-14 produced during different ages was the same. Wow, you know, what an assumption. That's what I remember. So but why does it have to be? So we know the sun goes through different solar flares and stuff like that. So then right away, maybe we're not so reliable to accept that. And then, therefore, the amount of carbon-14 in an animal really was influenced by the changes in the amount of carbon-14 he could have taken in during his life. Okay, to hell with that theory. One purport Prabhupada says they cannot really date things more than 3,000 years. And I think Prabhupada's really being generous in that, really being generous in terms of that 2,000 seems to start to really be pushing it, so on. So this is a different atmosphere. That's what we're kind of appreciating, this whole thing. And there was a Janamejaya, there was a Bhima Sen too. What was he like? You know, what kind of guy was he? Yeah. Would he have been a good temple president in Hawaii or GBC secretary? The whole atmosphere is so much more religious. Everything. And then also we see so much more in terms of different technological powers, what people can do. One devotee, I probably mentioned this before, Chandradas, he's a psychologist in the Snake River, Oregon State Correctional Facility, which to get accommodations, you have to rape somebody or murder somebody, or maybe if you set fire to a building, which is going to murder a lot of people or does kill a lot of people, then you can also get in there. So that's the general thing. So we went there doing programs, and it's amazing. So many people are big. I don't know why. It's big, And we had these programs, and maybe like about 100 prisoners, but there's a lot of prisoners, maybe like even 2,000 prisoners there. A very spooky atmosphere if you've ever been to a prison, because you suddenly, your mind is kind of just naturally checking out the environment. You realize that there's no way out of here. If somehow or other they make a mistake and they run a check on my identification, they make some mistake and decide I'm somebody else, I'm a prisoner. There's nothing I can do. So that's a real definite, influence on your consciousness. So we're there, and we're doing kirtan, and these are out of all these people. These are people coming to a Vedic thing and reading Bhagavad Gita and getting some enlightenment. Some initiated devotees in there too. So, interesting program with them, appreciating. But he said they started recently in the United States, as I remember. His explanation was this thing called genograms. And they start to investigate the genealogical history of the prisoners. And, of course, in America, the whole philosophy from the very beginning is ontological individualism, that the ultimate reality is the individual. And, of course, the cowboy on his high up on the straight back on his horse, conquering the frontier, or Horatio Alger finding some, $10 in a bag by the side of the street and buying apples and making a profit and selling them and opening a grocery store. And then, this whole thing in America, yuppie, you can have it all, whatever you set your mind to. But these genograms come out with this contrary result, which is, shocking kind of to the American consciousness. Somebody's in prison because he was a large-scale internet embezzler and really cheating people out of a lot of money using internet. Okay. His father was an automobile thief. His grandfather was a horse thief. So then what do you think his kids are going to be? Well, maybe it's the socio-cultural ambience being passed on, or maybe it's the DNA. It is a DNA for thievery. Like that, DNA for robbery, But, and more what it seems like is just the karma that we're talking about. We take birth in certain families, even now, If you think about it, you can talk, maybe you know these things more than better than I do. But yeah, there's studies that you take birth in a certain family because of a certain destiny, I in so many ways, I'm so much like my mother's grandfather. My great-grandfather on his side. I didn't want to hear about him, whatever, a little bit I could hear. And so then, we had to take birth in a certain family because of our destiny nature, and we get the right kind of DNA to do the job, and we get the right kind of socio-cultural upbringing to do the job. So the Vedic culture is a little bit careful about this, the different gotras. And these things are going all the way back. Gotras, I think, goes to like Bharadwaja Muni and this kind of stuff. And as far as getting inbreeding and imbecility and this kind of crazy stuff and diseases and deformed character, it appears that the Vedas had a very sophisticated idea that there was no problem with that kind of contamination if the gotras were separate like that, you know. And so they said there was marriage in the amongst cousin brothers and sisters like that, you know. So the genetics, the whole disposition there, the training, you know, the environment. Kshatriyas were big, powerful, they grew up fast. The Brahmanas weren't like that. They were smaller and maybe more prolonged childhood than the Kshatriyas. So they had more and more time to form their character, be educated like that. You know? I've heard the Prabhupada said, I don't know if I mentioned this before, that if we follow the principles strictly, and our children follow them strictly, then our grandchildren will be traveling on flying carpets. And it's my experience. The devotees are following pretty well. Maybe not a super strictly. Maybe not out of Mongolia, Arctic every day or some different things like that, you know. But even still, their children are like not ordinary people, you know. They really, even though they may not be interested in devotional service so much, or sadhana bhakti, still they're very celestial people in their character, everything else. And now, of course, is this what is this unlimited? It's almost a universal fact now, at least the boys I know, that they follow some principles of celibacy, they're vegetarian, and they're all big. All of them, a lot of them are big, friendly, popular, clever, and intelligent, you know, like that. And where they're going to go in society, what they're going to do for society, I don't know. But definitely it's going to be, it seems like it's going to be something good like that. You know? So it's very important, you know, so selecting the proper boy and girl, you know, for relationships like that. And for the, you know, the community to be involved, you know, the parents, everybody else, much more stronger fabric of community like that. You know? More and more we go on, Nirvishesha Shunyavadi, it seems like, you know, Prabhupada's description of these places was very accurate. That we are full of impersonalism. And America is kind of like exporting this. Our biggest export is impersonalism. You know? You know? Right now, actually, I lost track of time here because I'm trying to finish off my... we publish our newsletter, the Kapidwaja, every Amavasya and Purnima. So it was supposed to go out yesterday, but the festival is so intense here. It's incredible, you know. Janmashtami, sorry, Gopurnima, and the initiations, everything. So I'm trying to finish it off now. But it's nice because when we do it, we have to update our calendar, we have to update everything. You know, so I was going over all my mail, and there's one whole controversy going on about, you know, boys and girls, and who said what, who did what, and on like that. You know? But I can see, as far as I can tell, trying to also deal with the Spanish, that they weren't in consultation with their parents about what's happening. You know? Yeah. Whereas in Vedic culture, you know, even now, I know Indian families, that before the boy and girl would never see each other before the wedding. You know? And of course, the wedding means to be, what we say in America, engaged. The boy and girl would be engaged. You know, the way Prabhupada describes it, like the girl would be like 12 years old or something. You know, Sita was married before puberty. You know? And so about 11 years, 12 years old, and the arrangement's made. And so it's a whole different thing. At that point, the girl, just naturally, she's growing up, fixes her mind, her fantasies, her aspirations and dreams on this fellow. You know, she puts his picture on her altar along with her teddy bears. You know, and the different ceremonies, Prabhupada was describing them. And so the whole social fabric becomes so intense, the relationships between people like that. You know? And therefore, if you know, this is a fabric, if you pull one thread, it's felt all over the whole piece of cloth. You know? So same way, who's going to have children, what the relationships are going to be, becomes a whole very integrated thing like that. You know? And of course, it's subtle, so it also is connected to the devatas and that kind of thing. And so then the brahmanas, they have this technology. Yes, sir, we have the technology. We can do it, you know, to destroy all the snakes in the world. Yeah. I always have this aspiration that the Bhaktivedanta Institute will develop a technology to be able to turn all the U-238 in the world into lead, like that. And all these nuclear weapons. Of course, I guess, you know, we still have all the chemical weapons. Yeah. I don't know, maybe there's no way to avoid this mass destruction in Kali Yuga without people being reduced down to the level of morons or something. Yeah. It even says that when demon gave the, this is the second canto, one demon gave the knowledge of interplanetary travel to people. And they were going to different planets and killing people. So Buddha, different Buddha, he came to stop that. So it seems that actually mystical powers like this are possible in Kali Yuga. But eventually people, the only way to avoid it is to make people idiots, which Krishna accomplishes that finally. We seem to have lost all the technology which was represented in the pyramids and places like that, which some people speculate was geomagnetic technology. So it's kind of our ideas. This whole ambience is there, and Maharaj Janamejaya, will still go on doing wonderful things, but the age of Kali is there, and it's just natural. It's coming on slowly. Krishna is showing everybody, this is what happens. See the result. And so it's very quick. In this last 10% of the whole cycle, was it 40% of the whole cycle is nice. Satya Yuga, nice. You don't have to work. Kick it off the tree. And then 30% is what you work, what you get back, bountiful result, more than what you put in. 20%, nature's fair. You work, you get the result. And in Kali Yuga, you work and get less result than you put in. But it only lasts for 10%. The hard lesson, the tough lesson in Krishna school. But it's beginning. So Maharaj Janamejaya was hanging in there and doing things like that, and getting maybe his own comprehension, he knew it was destined. So my whole attitude, I see conflicts, so many levels in ISKCON. Actually, it's really tough on the heart if you're I'm kind of a more sensitive person, good and bad. Sometimes it's a good thing, but I'm more brahminical and shudra. So these battle of Kurukshetra is not for shudras and not for brahmanas, like that. So I kind of get involved in this politics, individual things like he's describing as the disciples, because I'm supposed to give the second initiation to somebody. Okay, and all these complaints about not bad, but it's definitely something a brahmana shouldn't be doing, and complaints. Oh my God, what am I going to do? And then socially and politically, then I'm somewhat involved also in the GBC work in South America, because we're going there. And in general, we see that it's just amazing how people can be, so insensitive to each other like that, But at the same time, too, I think maybe it's my own fault, because I don't realize that Kshatriya devotees say these things to each other, they do these harsh things to each other, verbally and stuff, mostly verbally in GBC and people like that, other devotees. But that's just the way Kshatriyas deal. They're more frank about these things. They express their passions, and nobody takes it so seriously, like that. And so, we've got to find our dharma, find our place. I think it's Maharaj Parikshit, with the ambience, everything else, the Kali Yuga is going on. But then the thing is, in the midst of this, my attitude more and more is just like, it's like that. It's just, don't worry about these things. It's going to go on. If we can make an ideal social, political arrangement with a king like Maharaj Parikshit, okay, do it. We can stop the Kali Yuga. But Prabhupada says, without him, forget it. You're not going to stop the Kali Yuga. And I guess the point at this point is that even Maharaj Janamejaya, he's not going to stop the Kali Yuga. I don't know how much his character has already been influenced by Kali Yuga. Maybe nothing. But he may be seeing, but no, Krishna doesn't want me to stop the whole thing. So then the question is what we can do. How much can we create amongst ourselves in a very, very complicated political situation in Peru for many reasons. So some people were trying to solve the whole thing. And I thought it was impossible from the beginning, and pretty much it's kind of like, you know, everybody agreed finally, you know. So I tried working with a few people on a certain area and developing his educational programs and making those a real contribution, you know, to the yatra in different ways. You know. Myself, when we were at Ramagat in Brajmanu Parikrama, kind of this idea came to me about what is administration. First thing, you've got to figure out who you are. You know, Chandika Pandit says one is good for puja, like that inspiration. So you do your japa, you do your worship of your deities, you do kirtan, you know, you talk to the authorities you respect, and you begin to see what is your psychosocial nature. It becomes clear to you. And then you see what is your what you don't know, like, I don't know this, okay, so don't worry about it, you know. Later on it might become clear. And then you have your clear mandate from your authorities in Krishna consciousness, what you're supposed to be doing. Okay, I have a kind of idea who I am. I did my work. And then we look for other people who have the same thing kind of clear with themselves. And then we can start talking about plans. Okay, I'm a teacher. I'm just convinced about that. Somebody else will say, well, I'm an administrator. And yeah, academic administrator is real natural for me too. Okay, we got a school. Pretty much all we're lacking now is parents and students, you know. But we're a long way. We've got to add teacher educators and stuff. So first, who am I? Who are we? What's the plan? And then start to acquire things, you know, houses, building, money, that kind of stuff. You know? But don't start with the, hey, Prabhu, I got a car, I got a house, my father gave me a computer. Well, what are we going to do? Well, I don't know. Let's make a plan. You know? Hey, what a great plan. Do you want to do it? No. Do you want to do it? No. I had directly seen big projects like that. You know, a great plan. Everybody thought it was a plan, but when you talk to everybody, nobody wanted to do it. They all thought somebody else will do it. Yeah. It's a great plan. Yeah. So this is my kind of humble contribution here today about Maharaj Janamejaya and taking birth in a certain family and the whole complex that it was possible at these times to do these sacrifices and, you know, and associate with these kind of people and change the world on subtle levels, you know, so powerfully, you know. And maybe again we can, in ISKCON, we should maybe take advantage of, you know, of appreciating these social factors. And, you know, it's an important aspect, I think, of our, I probably heard Prabhupada said in the future, at a marriage when people announce their gotra, many of them will say, oh, I'm a great, 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 great granddaughter of this Mataji who was initiated by Prabhupada. Yeah. Or I'm a great, 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 great guy's grandson of this fellow, you know. So our gotras will start right here. It's a fact. I know my parents, my grandparents. I remember my mother's grandfather a little bit. My father's grandfather, I never came in contact with him. I never asked my father. Now if he was alive, I would have gone through the whole thing and asked him everything that he knew about our family. And then, for example, my father has mild hemophilia, and so do I. My father's teeth all came out when he was about like maybe 66, and I've been able to hang on to mine, but I can see I get the same thing. So what to speak of the physical stuff, we may find out, you know, that our grandmother, grandfather, they're a certain way. Okay, now I see what kind of character I have looking at my family and how I should deal with things. And then we can make good plans for our service like that. That's kind of my comments. Okay, any comments, complaints, questions, anxieties?
Okay, I have unmuted thing. If anybody has any questions or comments for Maharaj.
Can I go?
You would like to ask a question? Go ahead.
Maharaj, do you have any comments about the extinct species propaganda which is made? Because Krishna says all the species exist all the time, but scientists say that we don't find all the species all the time.
Well, see, what I understand, our idea of origin of the species is steam, water, ice. Yeah. that that when the universe was created, okay, Garbhodakshaya Vishnu was there, and then Brahma came. And then first there were mental children of Brahma. Kashyapa, maybe one of them, or Brihaspati. So they were coming like that, you know. And so in the beginning of the universe, there weren't that many people. You know, maybe like 25, 30, 40 people or something like that. And somehow or other things going on here and there. You know? It's kind of interesting because some of the results appear to happen before the cause. But it's subtle. Okay. So in any case, then at some point here, Swayambhu Manu and his wife and his Satyarupa were created. And they were like Adam and Eve. They were in super goodness, doing all these austerities together. They had no agitation by sex desire, you know, this kind of stuff, you know. And they're just together as husband and wife for the advantage of doing austerities. But then Brahma said, hey, but we need biological reproduction. So they said, okay, we can do it, you know. But, you know, we can start eating more robust diet and this kind of stuff, okay, you know. But we can't do it on this level. It's just too subtle up here. So we have to be able to go down to Bhumandala. And we can't do that because Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakasipu has stolen Bhumandala. Okay, yeah. So then finally it all got adjusted, and then a few more offspring, Daksha. And Daksha, because he was too proud of his sacrifices, couldn't do his job, which was to create all the species. So he took birth again. And then Narada Muni kept turning his sons into sannyasis. So finally he created, I think it was 50 daughters. And they married all the bachelor sons of Brahma. And I think, again, Kashyapa took quite a few, Aditi and Aditi. So some of those girls became the mothers of the race of snakes. Others became the mothers of the race of horses. Yeah. So you might think about this. You know, how could a woman, you know, be the mother of the horses, you know? Well, that's thinking about it from a gross level. You know, women may have erotic dreams of having some relations with a horse, having offspring by the fellow, you know. But in a dream level, it can happen. You know, you have dreams like these, erotic dreams and weird stuff, you know. And in some ways, it's quite natural. You know, horses are very, you know, what you call it, very heroic, you know. Okay. So that's what I understand, that these things are all happening on this celestial level, which is like steam, and then it becomes gross like water, and then the steam can't fly anymore. It's fixed in certain characteristics, can't compress it so much. So we're starting to get like Kanaras, Gandharvas, Apsaras, and Bhuva, and those then become more gross, and finally we get Bhumandala. And things going on here, and reproduction, and different species. So the idea is that behind the gross species of horses that we see in certain rules for reproduction here, there's the blueprint. You know, the subtle format is there. And so that, I would say, depending on how high the species is, because even in biology, as far as I know, the species is pretty much more fixed than, was it phylum and genus? Species is defined as any group of living entities that can biologically reproduce and have biologically fertile offspring. So horses and donkeys can have biologically combined, but their offspring is sterile, it's a mule. So therefore, horses and donkeys are defined as a different species, even though they can produce offspring. So in some ways, it's a pretty kind of fixed definition, but there are also definitions of limitations to it. Yeah? But okay, what are the species? But at least according to our point, you know, 8,640,000 species, I would say that those are all, you know, there in the subtle form, the blueprint form, pretty much all the time. And sometimes they come out and don't come out on the gross level, depending on what's happening. So yeah, certain fish, for example, they say, oh, this species of fish was extinct, you know, 20,000 years ago or something, you know. But then they find one. You know, it's a famous story. They found one floating in the ocean, swimming in the ocean off Madagascar or something, you know. So like that, you know, by pressures, certain lines may get destroyed. You know? But you know, even that, as far as I know, now there's evidence that even just the existing species can permutate quite rapidly and reproduce missing species like that. So that's what I understand. Is that our point is it comes down like that. And for example, like, okay, steam can become water, that's H2O. But carbon dioxide cannot become water. And it's pretty much there's no water, maybe super weird circumstances, but normally carbon dioxide as a gas goes directly to dry ice. Okay, so the different kinds of steam have their different characteristics and what they're going to do under circumstances like that. They already have their different species of steam. That's okay?
And Maharaj, all these species have origin in spiritual world, you can say that?
Are all the species in the spiritual world?
Have their origin or reflection from the spiritual world, like we humans are here, so horses, donkeys must be in spiritual world also?
Yeah, as far as I understand, again, everything is reflected from the spiritual world. But as far as I understand, there's no like nasty scorpions in Vaikuntha, you know. So again, these different species may be reflected in, you know, more reflected in the mode of goodness, reflected in the mode of passion, reflected in the mode of ignorance.
Okay, Maharaj. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Maharaj, can I pick up from where the same question? Many times many times it's come up about the species. Of course, we know from our biology class in school the definition that you gave. If a species is designated by if it can reproduce and its offspring are not sterile. But in the Vedic literature, it's a little uncertain for how species, 8,400,000 species of life, how are those species designated?
I had the same point. I don't know. I don't think the Bhagavatam actually describes that. Because even Western Indologists, they have a bibliography of all known ancient Sanskrit literatures. Not even sure where they draw the line at ancient. But when it was last produced, it had over 160,000 ancient Sanskrit texts on the planet known.
Wow.
And so they discuss so many things like that. It's just like we're still sitting here with this gigantic treasure chest, you know, of stuff like that. And so people turn their interest where they think they're doing more to researching these things and using them, they'll find so much better information rather than, you know, the sources we have now. So I don't know how from Yojana. You know, Yojana is, so I did the Wikipedia, and the Yojana comes back down to a multiple of the width of the finger. So does that mean that the Yojana we're talking about was the Yojana that was current when Sukadeva Goswami was there? You know, when Ram jumped, what is it, 100 yojanas? No, Hanuman jumped 100 yojanas. Was that 100 yojanas at that time? You know. So again, you start to research these things like carbon dating and yojanas, and you start to find, you know, definitions. But I don't know what the species are according to the Vedas. Probably something very simple, very practical.
I have another question, but I want to wait.
One thing I always thought about the species was that a thought that I had was that all the species don't necessarily appear on this planet. I mean, we have a huge universe, and just like we have different continents, and on different continents there's different species and different conditions. I don't know if I ever read this or I just speculated, but of 8,400,000 species, I've always thought that they aren't necessarily all on this planet, and particularly at this time.
Yeah, I also, it's the same thing. I think probably even said the 400,000 includes the demigods.
Right, the 400,000 are different species of human, of which, you know, humans and demigods, the human-like form. That was my understanding, that was the 400,000.
Yeah, so those appear on different planets. You know? I think it also includes Gandharvas. You know?
Yeah. They're definitely not all on this planet.
Or at least we haven't got the senses and intelligence to perceive them, maybe.
Yeah.
that.
I'd like to ask another question, but is there anyone else that has a question or comment?
Yeah.
Maharaj, you said something very deep that you're starting to come to another understanding that perhaps those who have a kshatriya nature by their own nature, they sometimes can be harsh, especially in their words. You know, the devotees that have that kind of nature, it shouldn't be so surprising. There's some devotees, there's like one devotee in particular I'm thinking of, just so harsh. I've always thought, you know, like, oh, how can she survive? Like, ask about other devotees, you know, just every word that comes out of her mouth, it's like, oh, my God. Would it be more advisable, you know, instead of thinking this is aparad, just to say, well, she's probably a kshatriya nature, and therefore it's okay?
My goodness, yeah. No, because even the Pandavas, at some point, Bhima was so disturbed with Yudhisthira, he was like, you know, saying harsh things. But that's just like, I read Prabhupada one time, he said, the monks and girls, easy to fight, easy to forgive, you know. And so when I see girls fighting sometimes, I think, oh my God, this is going to be like horrible things. And then a few minutes later, they're apologizing and laughing, and it's okay, yeah. My goodness, you know. So the same way with brahmanas, you become angry like that, it's very serious, you know. But it's just kshatriyas, they're just, oh, you're just letting off steam, you know, forget it. You said you're going to kill me, oh, okay. So I don't know. You know, Vaishnava, I don't know. It kind of depends on the person. In some ways, too, you know, people shoot because they also become angry and say bad things about people, so forth and so on. So I don't know the kind of specific situation like that. But I think it's quite kind of what it is that it's just, again, this being a Vaishnava, actually, I'll get some more substantial ground here. Chapter 3, Prabhupada says that in chapter 2, Krishna didn't give enough detail for Arjuna to apply this stuff practically. And so he's confused. But in chapter 3, he's going to give more detail. He says, now we're going to come to vritti, you know, professional devotional service. You know? And so that's kind of like it. Is I'm a devotee, but yeah, what are you? Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, or Shudra? You're a man or a woman, you know? Child or an adult. You know? And so again, I always kind of think of myself as being Shudra, Brahmana, Brahmana, you know, according to different things like that. And so that, yeah, kind of, we really, being a serious devotee, we really have to understand. Next instruction again, Prabhupada says that one has to be educated in the basic principles of Varnashram. So beyond that, as things start to grow, then I think, yeah, it is important to understand your Varna and your Ashram and to express your devotional service through those media. You know? As we get, you know, again, Vyasadeva was in the same level as Sukadeva Goswami. But Prabhupada said because he was a Grihastha, he had to make this distinction between men and women. You know, so on. So apparently, what Prabhupada is saying is if he just took sannyas like Sukadeva Goswami, then he wouldn't have to make that distinction. He could just see everybody and just look into their eyes and just see their spiritual level and just engage in ecstatic Krishna kirtan with them, not even notice whether they had a male or female form. You know, but you know, because of the varna and the ashram, yeah, we have to understand people's positions. And then again, something maybe Vaishnava aparad, you know. Again, Pada Parvati, right? She couldn't appreciate Chitraketu and Lord Shiva's joking like that, you know? And so maybe they shouldn't have been joking like that in front of the ladies, right? Because ladies were taking it seriously. So it wasn't her fault so much because she was cursing and misunderstanding, but they weren't smart enough to say that these are kind of jokes amongst guys. Girls won't catch this. You know? Let's just be real careful here, you know? And same way girls, I mean, carry on. They're kind of joking and guy or whatever activities and guys become confused. You know? Okay, so it's very nice to develop. And the Bhagavatam is full of that. My experience, the Bhagavatam is more Daivi Varna Ashram Dharma than it does Bhagavat Dharma. Mm-hmm. It's taking us through all these psychosocial circumstances. So when some poor fellow like me has to deal with these conflicts in life, you can think about this and how to deal with this. You know, yeah. And again, it's like I said right now, I'm just convinced that this boy and girl and their relationships that they had, in some cases it was an option. That was their mistake. They didn't, like, as soon as these things started happening, they should have got their parents involved to, you know, so everybody knew what was happening and stuff like that. Yeah. So I guess we got to go. 4:30, we're supposed to go out and a little walk. I've kind of locked up, you know, doing all this stuff here in the temple and devotees, and we go for a walk at 4:30 around Buenos Aires. Maybe we'll see. Actually, the devotees, they do the kirtan sometimes, like the tango. Yeah, it's a nice. In many ways, it's much more interesting than North America. In many ways, people have real feelings. There's a lot of old buildings, and you get out and stuff like that. A lot of, and you see horses pulling carts in the street here.
Oh,
like that. Yeah, and then the fruit stores. They have a little fruit vendor, so common. On this place, sets his fruit out. You know. So, in many ways, it's very nice. And then we're gonna go. Out, maybe I make some phone calls because we're trying to organize some nice programs like that. But I think like this, next week we'll go to Mar del Plata, which is more south on the coast. Actually, it's south of the southern tip of Africa. We'll be there, and we have really good interfaith dialogue last time. Some really nice people, very interesting people. Maybe we can publish them this time. The Muslim guy has such a beautiful idea of how to relate to different religions. Yeah, that's a nice analogy. Yeah. Yeah. And then we'll... So next Friday, hopefully we'll be able, if you permit us, we'll be able to be online again. For us, it's 2:30 in the afternoon. Yeah. Okay. Well, any final comments? Anybody have any point there?
I wanted to thank you, Maharaj, so much for a wonderful class and that for a very interesting point you made. I never knew that Prabhupada mentioned that by chanting we can actually realize. If we even didn't read those stories, we actually can realize them. That's fascinating.
Yeah, so we're in a multi-generational project here. Okay, thank you very much. Shri Prabhupada ki jai.
All right.
Jai. Jai. Jai.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna.
Jai.
Hare Krishna.